So it's my pleasure to introduce Tom Payne today. Tom is a very well-known figure in clinical informatics. He's a practicing internist, so taking care of adult patients with a broad range of disease. He did an informatics fellowship at Massachusetts General Hospital and was first sort of came to big recognition for his successful leadership of the VA CPRMS deployment in the Puget Sound, receiving a Davies Award for that. For his variety of contributions, he was nominated and elected a member of the American College of Medical Informatics, has been at the UW, I just realized it's your 10th year at the UW, so you've been here a decade, leading a variety of clinical computing initiatives as the Chief Medical Information Officer. He is just entering into a big computerized provider order entry, your CPOE project. Today he's going to talk about clinical decision support use, and maybe sometime later this year we'll convince him to come back and give us an update on what's going on with computerized provider order entry, since he's given some nice presentations on that before. So thanks very much, Tom.
Great. Thanks, Peter, and thanks to all of you for spending your lunch hour on this topic, listening to me. I know some of you, but many of your faces are new to me, and I know at least one of your faces I'll get to know a little bit later today. I'm going to meet with me right afterwards. So the topic today, as Peter said, is clinical decision support use. And I wanted to focus on its use here in our halls. But before I do, I would like to set the context a little bit and give you some definitions, what I mean when I say computerized clinical decision support. Talk a little bit about what we have learned collectively about this field in the last 30 years or so. Review some of the national initiatives that make this even more relevant than it used to be here and elsewhere. Introduce the idea of diagnostic errors, which is a concept that I think we'll hear more about and maybe new to some of you in the audience. And then we'll get to the main topic, which is our use of computerized clinical decision support here at UW Medicine. There are barriers. I've identified some. The list I came up with is a little different than what I've read in the literature. So I'd like to let you know what I think the barriers are and what we can do about those barriers. And then also, because this is a group that has the opportunity and the time to work on these areas, I want to talk about opportunities if you have an interest in this area. So we'll start out with a definition, and I take this one from the American Medical Informatics Association, which is, I think, a reasonably complete one. It is, as you read here, it includes clinicians, patients, and individuals. I'm focusing more on the clinicians and the patients today, but that isn't to say that these other areas aren't just as important. With knowledge and person-specific or population information intelligently filtered, or presented at appropriate times to foster better health processes and ultimately for better individual patient care and better population health. So it's not just to help process. The ultimate goal is to make people better, stay healthier. We could all tweak this a little bit, I'm sure, but a lot of people tweaked away, and that's what they came up with. I think it's a reasonable place to start. And then a little history here, and I think it's a milestone in one's life when someone asks you to give an oral history, and somebody in a car said, "But we need to have you talk into a tape recorder because you know all these old things that happened," and I guess that's going to happen more in the future than it has in the past. But so here's my view of the history. I was very excited about this area, still am, but particularly in my fellowship years, and even before, when there was a great deal of interest in expert systems, ILiAD, that a derivative of this, it became known as QMR, Quick Medical Reference, DXplain, I worked on when I was a fellow. It's still in use in some areas. There was a great deal of exciting work done by the person who is now the president of AMIA, Ted Shortliff, on MYSIN and AUCASIN. These were rule-based expert systems destined to help, designed to help with the selection of antimicrobials, that was MYSIN, or the administration of chemotherapy, that was AUCASIN. Very exciting, very groundbreaking work. Later on, in the era when electronic medical records came into existence and were more broadly used, and also in understanding how these freestanding expert systems actually ended up not achieving all of their promise, we learned that embedding decision support into a electronic record, some system that has more information about the patient, turned out to be a promising approach to take. There was a great deal of interest in it, clinical event monitors, which are things that listen in on the chatter that goes on in an institution and runs rules. Those rules were expressed in the syntax called Arden syntax. There has continued to be a great deal of interest in exchanging information from one place where it might have been authored to another. And Arden syntax is an example of that, but there are many others. And there's a lot of initiatives now to sort of storehouse machine processable information and knowledge, and so that can be communicated elsewhere. And there has also been a great deal of interest in the over-learning phenomenon. Too much of a good thing, as it were. We'll talk more about that in a bit. I view what our history up to the point today is that we have a gap in translating what we have learned through research, through what a lot of very clever people have done over 30 years, into what we actually use in our patient care systems. So this, like in many areas of biomedicine, is an example of a translational problem, that what we know to be true and be helpful has not really been vetted in real production systems. And so that's my bringing the history up to the present. That history has resulted in an enormous body of literature on the subject. And I did a real quick measure of the size of that body of literature just by looking for the string decision support in Medline titles or abstracts. And you can see that since the late 80s, this has become a very, very popular topic. This is a one measure of that interest, but I think you've all seen examples of articles that have shown up that review what has been known about decision support. One that just showed up in the most recent JAMIA issue is written by several folks from Virginia and Don Detmer, the outgoing president of AMIA, on progress and opportunities. They reflect on an AMIA effort, which was actually AMIA and other organizations put together a roadmap for national action on clinical decision support that Jerry Ashraf and Jonathan Teich were primary leaders on. And the article in JAMIA this month is sort of reflecting on where we stand with this roadmap. The roadmap said that we have basically three pillars, that we ought to have the best knowledge available when it's needed. There should be high adoption and effective use of this knowledge. And we should continuously improve the knowledge and the methods we use to deliver the knowledge. So those are the three pillars of this roadmap. Easy to put into a bullet on a slide, but harder to bring into action and to keep following in your production systems, in your healthcare organization. My own history with this started with an article by someone who many of us know quite well, Clem MacDonald. He wrote a paper in the New England Journal the year I started medical school called Protocol based computer reminders in the quality of care and the non-perfectibility of man. I guess we would say humankind now. The idea there is we all have weaknesses, and systems have weaknesses too. But some of their weaknesses don't necessarily overlap with our own. So could there be a combination of these two, the human, the computing system, to reduce the problems that we face? And a good example of this is from if you're taking out from National Airport, you look out over the wing. I took this picture. And if you look carefully, you can read that it says, follow noise abatement procedures. This is a reminder to the pilot as they're taking off. These are highly trained pilots. And yet, these reminders are there so that they don't forget to do whatever it takes to make the plane a little bit quieter. So that's the history. We translate that into the computer world, and you have a classic reminder. This is a alert that shows up if you're ordering amoxicillin on a patient who is known to be allergic to penicillin. So that's sort of the current incarnation of what Clem observed quite some time ago. Then there was a paper published, also history now, 7 years ago, by David Bates, Gil Cooperman, and others on rules for effective clinical decision support. And if you haven't read this paper, it's worth reviewing. I have the references at the end. And they outline 10 rules that they think really help in decision support many of you have probably seen this paper, but it's also important to reflect on things that are on this list that we don't do as often as we should. Monitor impact, get feedback, and respond is just one of those. That single line is probably underutilized in most places, including our own, I would say. National initiatives, all this is not going
to
notice.
I just want to go back up one slide. I just want to make a point, which is I think that that 10th bullet there is really critical to emphasize because one of our PhD students' dissertation focused on the fact that the drug-drug interaction databases are factually incorrect, a lot of them, that they're really, really difficult to maintain. And as we start moving toward things like genomic medicine, they're putting more and more of these rules in. Yeah, 10 rules is pretty easy for healthcare provider, nurse, pharmacist, physician to review and say, yeah, that looks right. But as what is being envisioned here involves hundreds to thousands of rules, and trying to make sure that they're all accurate and that they don't have weird interactions between them is going to be a really interesting challenge, and possibly dissertation or two.
I don't know if you saw that cartoon in the paper the other day. It showed this big spider web with a cow in the middle. And it says, if it's on the web, it must be true. So, you know, if you read things, see them in a database, question. Okay, so national initiatives. All this has not gone unnoticed by our leaders. It's interesting that our current health IT leaders in our nation are our friends now. It's not someone else. It's people we know who are now in a position to actually try to enact this on a national level. A little frightening. First time that's happened to me. So what are these national initiatives? Well, our own organization, or for those of you who are members of AMIA, has been very active in this area. Lots of activity, lots of initiatives that have to do, a lot of what this has to do with is capturing and communicating knowledge. So the Morningside Initiative and others are efforts to try to make this knowledge available to places that don't have to start from scratch. The Office of the National Coordinator has convened several groups. One of them, the CEAT Clinical Decision Support Work Group, met in August. It will meet again in December. And it's a crowd of really nice, friendly people who do their best to give advice. Hard to get advice from 55 people in one room, but they do their best. And the proceedings of this are available in the ONC website. In our own now Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services world, this is the ONC website, they talk about the priority of making better decisions. It's being something that we as a nation want to move toward. In fact, it appears in our legislation. This is taken from the Federal Register. One of the things there that is important for us to do, it says, is implementing clinical decision support medication management. So this is real now. This is actually hitting law. And again, that's a little bit scary. You have to reflect a little bit when things become law that you're pushing the right things and you're doing it well, and that makes you want to get another cup of coffee and work just a little bit harder. So alerts. We're pretty sure that alerts are sort of the foundation. We're going to incent people to use them. That one is done, right? Well, not exactly. This is an example of a classic alert. You're about to order an imaging test. Somebody who has impaired renal function, this pops up. Got to be helpful. Could be, but it might not be. Sometimes these alerts are overridden. We've seen this literature. But take a look at this graph. This is from the vaunted Brigham. Okay, that's the source of a lot of literature in this field. Starts out in 1995. This graph goes for 5 years, to the end of 1999. And what you measure here is total and overridden allergy alerts. And what you see here is that it starts out looking promising. It ends looking not so promising. The override rate started out 53%, rose to 76%. And the second thing to observe here is this paper was done in 2000. So launched in 1995, papers presented at AMIA in 2000. 5-6 years elapse, and these problems are identified and correctable. I mean, the Susan Abiquir had a list of things that resulted in this, and all correctable. Took a thoughtful analysis, but it could be done. So that's one that we think we have down. We actually don't have it quite as down as we thought we did. And then there are other things that we have great ideas for, which we haven't used. And here's one from Scott Evans on helping with selection of antimicrobials in the ICU, which is a very complicated and important domain. You have somebody who's sick, sick enough to be in the ICU, needs antimicrobials because there's a suspicion of systemic infection, and you need to pick a drug that they're not allergic to, that is likely to help with the pathogens that have been cultured, knowing the resistance pattern of those microbials in your institution, knowing the hepatic function, the renal function of the patient, and knowing the clinical condition that you suspect have resulted in infection. All of that has to be considered when you choose these. What he showed in this, it wasn't a randomized trial, was that the computer can help you there, and it can help with outcomes. So here we are in 2008 is the next slide, a decade later, translating this into the real world, and here is my resident, very bright young lady, choosing antimicrobials for a patient on our medicine service using a clinical decision support system in a book. That's why I put computerized at the beginning. We do a lot of decision support that isn't computerized. Very helpful, very common, but that's not what I'm talking about today. So there's a translational issue. Scott Evans' idea likely has to be replicated, has to be studied, has to be refined, probably has a kernel of truth in it, but it really hasn't hit broad use. Actually, in LDS Hospital, the place where this work was done, it isn't always used. It's used some of the times, I hear, anecdotally. So another critical look at this is from the Canadian Medical Journal that many of you saw, questioning how effective reminders are, and what they show is this analysis of reminders, computerized reminders on behavior, and you can see that these stratify into some that, wow, that's an impressive effect, and some where, you know, hard to say, and then some in the middle. So what do you conclude from this? That they really don't work? You might also conclude that some of them do and some of them don't. So, well, what's the difference between the two? The paper talked about a lot of these coming from the Brigham or from institutions that have homegrown systems. But some of the dots on there are from Mike Kroll, Northwest Kaiser. So this is not the Brigham. They had a pretty good effect. I have a feeling that this is showing that it isn't an automatic benefit, but that there's probably something in there that if you do it properly and refine it, it can be helpful to you. I think Clem McDonald was right. Now, diagnostic errors, this is something that, is this a familiar, is this a term that a lot of you know? Some of you do, some of you maybe not. I really think this is an interesting area. It is something that Gordy Schiff and David Bates brought up most recently in the New England Journal just this last year. And their point is, a fundamental part of delivering good medical care is getting the diagnosis right. Diagnostic errors are common, outnumbering medication and surgical errors as causes of outpatient malpractice claims and settlements. The problem with having too much information is now surpassing that of having too little, which is the case in my clinical practice. You have a chart with 300 notes, 80 imaging tests, thousands of test results. You still have 20 minutes with that patient. And after that 20 minutes, there's another patient who has the same thing, and so on. And I'm only in clinic a half day a week, and many of our practitioners across the country are in clinic all day long seeing many more people than I do. So this is a challenge, and it's not surprising that we sometimes don't get it right. We can write a safe order with a drug that they're not allergic to for the wrong problem. So better if we wrote that safe order for the right problem. So how common is this? A survey that Gordy did shows that if you ask practitioners and keep them blind, they're anonymous, you find that major errors happen. People reported major errors, 28% of the respondents did. Moderate errors, 41%. And how commonly did this occur? Many of them said it happens commonly, 8%. Some of them said occasionally. So diagnostic errors are not rare. They happen. How do we get rid of them? What can we possibly do to get rid of diagnostic errors? This is my brainstorming. What about a grand problem list? Jonathan and I talked about this just last week. You know, you've got a problem list in every single note you write. We're all kind of SOAP trained. But those notes go back 6 years. What about culling out the thinking of your predecessors who maybe saw the same elephant from a different angle and pulling all those together, finding out where there's redundancy but where there might be food for your own thought when you have such a limited amount of time? What about those diagnostic expert systems that we talked about in the first few slides? Is it time to revisit how they could help us now? What about a question list? We have a problem list. But equally important in science and in medicine is what are the questions? And those are sometimes listed, but ignored. They're not on a problem list. What about the pedigree? We ask questions all the time. Does anybody in your family have cancer? Anybody have heart disease? Did anybody develop heart disease early in life? That's usually narrative text lost. In my own practice, the last month, 3 patients, heritable disease I wasn't aware of until we started probing here. And they've had it all their lives, of course. So these are ideas for diagnostic errors. But now let's switch to the real world here, which is what the title said I was going to talk about. All right, so where do we stand today in UW Medicine? First of all, not everyone here knows the boundaries of UW Medicine, so I'm going to explain that briefly here. We have 4 hospitals. We used to have 3, now we have 4. There are Harborview Medical Center, UW Medical Center shown here. We have Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And most recently, we have Northwest Hospital. It's more like a community hospital. It's up by Northgate. We have, if you add them all together, about 1,200 beds. We have about 60,000 admissions a year. That's a lot of people. This ranks as sort of intermediate style organization in size on a national scale. Bigger than most, but not as big as many. We have about 2 million outpatient and ER visits a year in our system. A lot of people come through our system. Northwest is a very busy place, but so is Harborview and so is the U. We have a lot of people working here. I don't have the data on nurses from Northwest, but I do from the rest of our system. We have about as many residents as we do nurses. The practicing attending physician number is lower than this, but the order of magnitude here is thousands. So there's a lot of people getting care from a lot of healthcare professionals. This is UW Medical Center. This is Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, South Lake Union campus. This is the Northwest Hospital, one of the entrances. And this is the Harborview Medical Center campus, which is bigger, seems like every year. So that's what we mean by UW Medicine. Which EMRs, and I'm limiting today's discussion to EMRs. There's a lot of other things we could talk about. Let's talk about EMRs today. We have a lot of them in use. We use Cerner Millennium. In most of our clinics at the moment and our inpatient areas, except for Northwest. Epic is used in many places in the neighborhood clinics, Central Eastside Specialty, Alderwood Cardiology, Bone and Joint, Eye Institute, and an increasing number of clinics are moving to Epic for the outpatient care. We use NeoData in our neonatal ICUs, not only here but in many of the community hospitals around the UW. Siemens Sorian is used at Northwest, and we use a system called DocuSys in the operating suites of Harborview and the U. There are others too, and I don't mean to be completely comprehensive with this list, but the major ones that account for the majority of people who receive care in that list I gave you earlier are represented here. So we've been busy with implementing these EMRs. There have been a few examples of decisions board that I'd like to highlight, and some of them, in fact, I think most of the examples I'll give you here, had something to do with somebody who was sitting in your shoes not too long ago. So the first one comes from Barry Aronson, who was a fellow in BHI. And this, Barry's idea was a very good one, and as soon as I heard it, I thought, that's a great idea. And this is why. This is one of my patients when I was here on service 2 years ago. You can see here vital signs, which we record electronically. And you can see at the top is the heart rate. In the middle is the systolic blood pressure. And in the bottom is the hematocrit. And you can see that the heart rate is fluctuating. And the blood pressure is also fluctuating. But then the heart rate goes up at night. But everything else stays about the same. And interns call, the nurses concerned. A few things are done, but not much. And then the next morning, we come in on Saturday morning. Hematocrit is very low, like 60. The systolic blood pressure is dropping. And you can see the frequency of the dots rises. That's because the person goes to the ICU. And the ICU is the frequent dot area, and the patient did okay, actually. She had been bleeding into her chest from a chest biopsy. And the clue was right there. And had we had our rapid response team evaluate her, it's possible that we could have avoided this precipitous drop in the hematocrit and the transfer to the ICU. So how about if we use those vital signs that we're collecting for reminders or alerting to people who might take a second look at the patient? That's what the hypothesis was, that maybe this would help. So Barry created, with the help of many people, including maybe some of you, this score that is an integer. And the higher the integer, the more interesting the patient should be to the rapid response team group. It's a relatively crude index as it starts in the first trial. It may not be the exact algorithm we should use, but the idea, I think, is promising, that checking the numbers that we gather every day by many people, not just one. For one person, they probably know the big picture, but it's actually many people. You calculate a score, and that score tells you how interesting this patient might be, whether they're likely to have clinical deterioration. So this is an example of decision support that's a little different than a reminder, but I think also quite promising. So that's the score. Another one is to look at not just one patient, but every patient in the ICU, look at the treatments they're receiving and see whether they conform to our own standards for care for people in the critical care unit, for preventing blood clots in the legs, bleeding in the stomach, controlling their blood sugar, and giving them immunizations and other measures that everyone should have. If it's all green, we're doing fine. If it's not green, we have to check on that patient. It makes it explicit, and we actually use this now. We're testing it in our ICU. So this is a decision support that came out of our program and is on the wards being tested now. There are other examples. This is a summary screen that some of our graduate students from Upper Campus helped David Stone create and others. And it, what it does is take all this data that we've got and put it in a form that you can digest without clicking on, you know, six tabs. And there's a link here that allows you to search for information that might be interesting and up to date. So, just to be a little more systematic now, in the last half hour, I want to give you my thoughts on how it's possible that computing systems can help us with clinical decision making. What can they do? Now, an interesting biological fact for you to think about is, what is the human being capable of doing? And someone in medical school told me, human being can do two things. It can contract and secrete. So we a muscle, that's contraction. Neuron synapses, that's secretion of certain chemicals. So, but we do wonderful things. Mozart contracted and secreted in a particularly interesting way. So what can computers do that would help us to make decisions better? You boil it down, what could they possibly do? The first is they can simplify access to data you need to make decisions. So if the hematocrit is 12, but you don't know it, you're not going to make the right decision. We can remind people explicitly, not only make the data available, but tap them on the shoulder. You need to remember such and such. And a reminder, you remember to do something at the moment, 3 months later, did you still remember to do it? A reminder can be quite helpful. That's the Clement Donald example. We can check orders. If we're communicating an order for a service, a medication, a consult, a lab test, an imaging study, we can check it against rules that we have created and perhaps make the order a safer, more effective order. We can guide orders, meaning suggest things that you might want to order that you didn't think of. So not only are they safe, but they're complete and appropriate to the condition. We can help by reviewing new clinical data and alert someone when important patterns are recognized. So if you have a hematocrit that's 12 and it used to be 20, let somebody know. But that's a little easier than if the hematocrit is 37, but it used to be 47. That 10-point drop might not be obvious if you just looked at the 37. We can monitor treatment. We embark on treatment with a medication that increases risk for infection or could cause metabolic abnormalities. One could argue that it's incumbent upon you then to make sure that you monitor that treatment. Part of your obligation to the patient is not only to give them a treatment that can help them, but to make sure that it's used and monitored safely. We can put links into the systems that we use that make it easier to get to other kinds of information. So links to external resources. They're not necessarily in mind, but they might be appropriate, and if they're easy to get to, we might learn from them. We could help in documentation. We could say, you're about to write a discharge summary. How about following this set of this outline? And did you remember to talk to the patient about the medications they're taking, that sort of thing? We can help in diagnosis. That is, your list is a great one. It's missing a few things that you might want to consider. So I'm going to go through those in a little more detail. Simplify access to data to make decisions, results review, specialized displays. That's sort of the bread and butter of clinical computing. That's where we started, really, with laboratory systems. We bring data to people so that they can make decisions easily. Alerts and reminders, health maintenance. We've done this a lot. You're 67 years old. Have you had an influenza vaccine if you're not allergic to it and the season's right? You have type 2 diabetes. Have you had your eyes examined? Your bone marrow is different. You had a bone marrow transplant. Should we let your doctors know that should you be in an accident, that we need to take special precautions when giving you a transfusion? What about your risk to the worker, if this person's behavior puts the healthcare worker at risk, that sort of thing? Those are alerts and reminders. Order checks. This is where we spend a lot of our time in talking about clinical decision support. It's one of, I don't know, 8 bullets I'm giving you here, though. Drug allergy, duplicate drug or service, dose range checking, weight-based ordering, dosage adjustments for renal and hepatic function, and age-specific vital signs checks. By that I mean, this is a neonate and you just put in 70 kilos. I mean, 70 kilos is okay for a grown-up, but probably off there. So that sort of thing. We can guide orders. We can have pre-configured orders. You don't have to start from scratch. We're going to put amoxicillin, 500 milligrams, 1 POTID there. You don't like that, you can change it. But if it's the right one, that pre-configured order saves you time and makes it a little bit easier to be correct. Order sets, collections of orders, rules that run when you write an order, corollary orders, meaning you're about to order this drug. Most people who take this drug have this one handy in case they need it. You know, like you're taking a narcotic to kill your pain. What about the stool softener? A corollary order sort of follows the first one with the second one as a suggestion. Templates and calculations, very important, particularly in people whose weight is changing quickly. Relevant labs, that's guiding orders. Review new clinical data. I think you have a sense of what that is. Critical values for lab, if it's way out of line, we usually bring that to your attention through professional conversation. We have a harder time doing that in the electronic world, flagging it, because you never want to just something that important. You don't want to rely on one system only. You want to have a backup and maybe a triplet. So for critical lab, what about critical radiology? What about critical anatomic pathology? And if the person wants to be paged when a result is available, do we make that available? Computers can help with all those things. Monitoring of treatment, warfarin, digoxin, those sorts of drugs do need to be monitored because they have a narrow therapeutic index. If you use slightly wrong dose, it could be dangerous to you. And we also need to bring you back from time to time to check you while you're on these drugs. Embedded links, we talked about UpToDate. I showed you an example. Micromedics, there are lots of other things that it'd be handy to have quick access to, and templates for writing notes. So this is my list, and at the end you can add to it, but this is what I think about when I think about computerized clinical decision support. So let's see how we are doing with this now. So what I've done is to go through the UW Medicine systems, and I'm using
two of them as an example, because otherwise there's too many dots on the slide. But the same principle applies. And I asked people at Virginia Mason, Chicago, Seattle Children's, Evergreen Swedish, Everett Clinic, Northwestern, a few other people too, how they're doing with respect to each of these areas that I just got through listing. This is not complete. I would take this as a place to start, because those of you who know the answers here might disagree with the dots I've got here, and I'm open to suggestions. But it's a reasonable start on where we stand today with those categories. So, first of all, on the simplify access to make decisions, I think we're doing pretty well. And compared to the nation in our region, it looks like we're taking pretty full advantage of what we have available to offer. When it comes to alerts and reminders, there's some obvious gaps. And for example, on the Cerner side, we do not do health maintenance reminders. We don't do condition-specific reminders. We do some of these other categories. In the Epicare sites, they do a better job with health maintenance. They have an interest but haven't yet spent much time on condition-specific reminders. And the purpose of the rest of the slide is to sort of answer the question, well, is it possible that the software we're using doesn't have that feature? And it helps to know that a site that has, say, an E, which is an Epic, or a C, which is a Cerner, that has a check there, it makes you wonder, maybe you actually could do it. It isn't the software, it's something else. So there's a gap in one of the early areas where we found clinical computing decision support systems to work. Order checks, well, we've just launched our CPOE project here, so I put gray boxes in there, and you can see that in the Cerner side, there is one duplicate drug or service. We're not planning to do that, and the reason that it's not in many sites is that it's really hard to do without annoying people. Because what the computer thinks is a duplicate, the clinician might think is not a duplicate at all. On the Epicare side, they have the basics in. They're interested in extending that, but haven't done so. Although in other Epic sites, you can see, let's say, Swedish. There's more checks in that area. Now, it may be a little bit the way they answered the question or interpreted the question. I don't know, but it makes you want to investigate that a little bit. Guiding orders. This is all gray for the Cerner side. We haven't done it, but we're planning to do it. And on I think this is incorrect. I'm sorry. Oh, no, rules. The idea of a rule that you run an if-then sort of rule on the trigger of an order, at least in our team's response to this question, we aren't taking advantage of that yet, although you can see at Swedish they are, so I think it's probably something we could do. Corollary orders, same thing. This is an area of active work. Malia and Martin Gunn and I are working on a project for identifying values for radiology that are regarded to be critical, and also the text within a narrative text of a radiology report that suggests need for further testing, which is dictated in by the radiologist, known by the person who gets the report, but sometimes that isn't the same person who sees the patient when that new imaging test is due. So could you somehow make that harder to miss? And since these are narrative text reports, NLP might be a useful tool there. Critical values for anatomic pathology, the only yes I got out of that was Evergreen. Paging, Epic does that. In our site, apparently not in the other sites. So there is potential here. Monitoring for treatment, we have prominent gaps here on the Cerner side, and we'll talk more about that in a minute because Beth Devine has an idea. And then aid in diagnosis, really nothing. Not a single site is helping with that area, at least as I pose the question. So that's where I see us, where we stand today. I just want to go back to some of the areas where we've been making more progress. And if you say simplify access to data instead of DATRA, this is the classic slide that shows results review. But we are moving on from that. And this is the way we'll be looking at blood sugar results before long. And this is very clever.
Our endocrinologists at Harborview and at the U have helped us design this, and it shows not only the grid that you saw there, but also timeline and the sugar result that comes not only from the blood, but from the finger prick, and also the relationship to meals and what sort of insulin treatment has been given as a result. So it puts it all together. So that's simplifying access to data, but in a better way than we've done before. Now, here is the one where we talked about monitoring data. Beth Devine in the audience here has been working on this. It's a project that Bruce Lambert and others at UIC in Chicago have organized. And the hypothesis here is that not all of us have fully implemented electronic medical records. Most of us do not have computerized practitioner order entry across the country. But most of us have a pharmacy system and a laboratory system, because those are usually the first places beyond billing that we put in computing in our hospitals or our clinics. Would it be possible to make simple rules that look through data from those two places to draw attention to problems or omissions, or at least raise the question? So these are 26 examples of pairs of lab and medication results that raise the question of whether monitoring has been appropriate. And the idea is you can create rules that any institution should be able to run with a little effort and help our teams, including the clinical pharmacists, identify problems before they're clinically apparent. So that is a computerized clinical decision support system that doesn't require the full infrastructure that most of these others that I've shown you today does. So now I've shown you the slide that has all of the checks on it, and I'm going to summarize what I've learned from looking at this, and one of my reasons for being here in front of you today. It's my opinion that clinical decision support is used at a level far lower than its potential to help nationally, but also here at UW Medicine. I think we have much more work we can do. I think one of the problems that we aren't recognizing as much is that we are missing information because we have such massive records that make it very difficult to find things. And the good news is that if you do have the time, the information is available from many different locations. The bad news is we usually don't have the time. So I think that is a new frontier, not so new, but for me it is. I think it's also true that you can see from this, despite decades of research, a lot of the things we have found to be effective and relatively simple are not available from EMR vendors. A good example of this is that you're ordering a TSH, a thyroid test. As you order it, how about showing the most recent TSH for that patient in the ordering screen? You don't have to decide if it's a duplicate or not. You let the clinician decide, and they don't have to do anything else to make that determination because it's right there on the screen. And if it turns out, I didn't know he had one 3 months ago, that's good enough, you cancel your order. If you think, well, it was 2 years ago, he's different now, I think I want to go ahead with it, fine. But you didn't have to go flipping through the lab to find the TSH. That simple intervention in the 80s resulted in something like a 12% reduction in test ordering at Regenstrief. Bill Tierney published that. I've yet to see that in an EMR today, and we spend tens of millions of dollars on these things. So that's an example of something that clever idea, seemed to work, not available in a commercial system that I'm aware of. And it's also true that a lot of things that are available in the EMR systems we're not using. I think our alert on alerts, our focus on alerts for prescribing has diverted attention from other important decision support areas, and I gave the example of diagnostic errors. I'm not going to say for a minute that it isn't important to focus on prescribing. That's very important. But I think we should observe that as we focus there, the spotlight isn't shining somewhere else. And it probably should. So now, barriers. Why are we in this state, Tom? Why? I mean, you're the head medical director of IT here. So come on. So why haven't we done it? And here is my answer to the question. And I'm not going to say it's defensible, but I see our current state
and our potential on this slide, there's a barrier between them. So what is in that barrier? Well, we spent a lot of time on putting in charms. Very important. It's a billing system, facility billing system for the entire system. No margin, no mission. You don't bring in revenue, you can't carry on your clinical mission. It's very important. Pro-fee billing, same issue. Very important. The time we spend doing that, the time I spend doing that, I am not spending on some of these other issues. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, I'm just saying that's my experience. We're pretty busy installing EMRs. You know, we're putting in CPOE. We are putting in Epic in many clinics. You go over to Northwest, they're putting in systems. So that takes people, it takes time. We have to focus. That means less time for some of these other systems. And that has been going on for quite some time. We always have some new problem. There's some urgent need that we have to address quickly. This is the reality of any complex system, computerized or otherwise, that there's always something urgent, and the people who respond to that are then not available for some of these other purposes. There is the sort of less visible and less spectacular area of infrastructure and operations. We have to keep the system running. We have to respond to downtimes. We have to plan. All of these things take time. Then when it comes to the decision support discussions, we have to prioritize where we're going to invest. We have meetings to discuss this. What's most important? And then finally, what are the rules going to be? What's the content? And actually, now final. Then we talk about creating and sharing content. So my view of this, and I go to a lot of these committee meetings across the country that you all go to too, I think we spend a little too much time on that, which is important. But I think it doesn't really explain why we are not meeting our potential. And what can we do about it here? Well, first of all, I think that by national standards, we here at UW-Medicine are average. We're pretty good. We're not great. And we should be great. I think we have a lot of tools. We don't get around to using all the tools. So it's not blame Epic, blame Cerner, blame Sorian. It is to some degree, and we certainly don't let that stop us from blaming them. But it is also true that they have heard from thousands of users before us. They put in system features that we don't use. I also think that we have opportunities, and this room could be part of that. I mean, there are opportunities to do better, to put us in somewhere close to the standards that we have. And one is we could focus on areas that are known to work, and I would take a little disagreement with the CMAG article that said that reminders are kind of middling poor. I would say they can be terrific. They can be very helpful. Or they can have little impact. It has to do a lot with how you use them. So I think if we focus on the things that work, we can get more benefit than we get today. I think there are PhD theses to be written on nothing more than measuring and the impact of current clinical computerized decision support systems and production systems. There's certainly master's theses, and there are certainly projects. Susan's paper, 6 years at the Brigham. Why did it take 6 years? Because I think they had the same barrier slide that we do. But we need to know how these work and how they don't work. And don't let a negative study discourage you. That just means you didn't hit the ball first time at bat. You got two more swings. You've got more than two more swings. We need to know the answer. Does it work or does it not? And that takes rigorous, thoughtful, clever asking of questions and answering them. I think there's a whole wide open frontier in the area of diagnostic errors that probably ought to be thought about more than it is. Are we missing something in this patient? Can they be involved in helping us find out what that is? Are we focusing on the right thing? I had a patient yesterday whose PSA came back, elevated. I ordered for, not for screening, but for
symptoms. And it took me, I don't know, 5 minutes to look only through my notes, back 5 years. Finally, I went back to a section of that note where this same problem was addressed by me because he brought records from his prior physician, and I could see the thinking, the conclusion that they reached on this same problem 5 years earlier. So that sort of thing kept me from making a mistake. I had the time to do it. I wasn't in clinic. Okay? I was at my desk. So there's a lot of more of that sort of thing going on, and I think that's an area that we should pay more attention to. And I encourage you to read the paper that Gordy and David Bates wrote on this. I think there's another area that I think we are obviously one leg up on for the rest of the country, and that is the recognition of heritable disease. That, Peter could probably spend the next 2 hours on this very subject, but I think in the clinic, I'm humbled by how common this problem is and how we don't recognize it, and we didn't have it to recognize 3 years ago. We don't have that excuse anymore. Now it's just, how do we help people make life-changing decisions based on information that's already there in our system? I think that's a very interesting question. And I will go back to this reference. This is just not a complete list, but it's the things that I refer to in this talk, and I think these are each worthy of taking a few minutes to review. I did not mention NeoData. I did not mention DocuSys. My fault. But there are lots of other things to say about other systems. And I hope that we ask more questions than we used to as a result of this hour.
Tom, I'd like to ask you how your experience here relates to that on clinical decision support systems that Bob Greenis wrote in his book about 2 or 3 years ago, Clinical Decision Support Systems, The Road Ahead. And he said, for 40 years, we had developed nothing in common that was shareable, and that we needed to do something about it. And you kind of reflected much of that.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that sharing is it's a way, it's sort of a foundation of science, really. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people working on this very domain, including Bob. That Morningside Initiative is Bob's project. I guess my observation would be, as important as it is, it's only one of many factors. I made it a very small part of my barrier because I think that there are many other things that addressing earlier and harder would help, including collaboration, including helping get good ideas, doing the hard work of getting it into the real world. I think that's something that this audience could find
sharing,
very satisfying.
The sharing could provide incentives and rewards or clear targets to industrial suppliers to provide the functionality and the components, the implemented systems, that you could include in your architecture if, in fact, the collaborative posture that you mentioned were in place. I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, I think just what I said about Bob Greenis' work, I think it's very worthwhile.
Hi.
Hi.
Kind of refreshing on your talk today. I really totally agree with your opinion that diagnostic data is the most important part when you go into your support system. But in the situation, I kind of have, when you make a long diagnosis, the following treatment, right, will be very long and that will be kind of dangerous to
Yeah, so observation, thank you very much for the, your agreement on the decision support. The multiple vendor is a challenge in that usually the work to connect the data that each system uses or creates, that work falls to the customer rather than the vendor itself, with some exceptions. The vendor's purchased five places, five different systems, they take on that. But usually it's up to us. So it does influence our ability to use decision support, because if you don't have complete data and you give a recommendation to repeat a test, for example, but the test was already done, then the credibility of your decision support drops. So that's an example of where multiple systems make it harder than if you have a single system. So in the VA, for example, most of it was in a single system. So the decision support was pretty comprehensive. If you didn't have a TSH in the VISTA database, odds are pretty good nobody did a TSH on you. Whereas here, if you come from one of our neighborhood clinics or from Northwest, we're not sure. You might have had it, so we're not sure if our reminder to get this test would be credible or not. That's just one example. So, very good question, and you say, I'm not a doctor, and I'll say, well, I am a doctor, and I'm not the one to necessarily know the answer to that. I think how we present it in a way that's helpful, not distracting, is a very interesting question. And then, how do you get it out of that note from 1995? That's another very interesting question. I think that you and I agree that there's potential there to help. And I think that is a really intriguing question that we are now in a position that we can start testing ideas and collaborate with people who do know a lot about extracting data and who do know about user interface design and can do it in a way that people say, yes, yes, that helps. Wouldn't that be refreshing? Instead of papers and, you know, my medical journals on, you know, there's the pendulum swung to the, oh my God, another note from an EMR. That's where the pendulum is right at the moment. So I think we need fresh ideas on that, personally.
Really appreciate for the presentations. There's a term in the business world called Lean Six Sigma.
Yes.
And it was practiced originally from manufacturing productions. And I know for the last few years, it actually moved to many different areas. And I'm just curious whether it's something that has been practiced, maybe for a system like this.
Well, not by me. And not because I'm not impressed with it. The closest, I'm not sure I'm saying this correctly, but yeah, my friends at Virginia Mason use a lean process. I think it's the same idea. And they are experts, I am not. What I do notice is that their general internal medicine clinic, which uses an EMR, has margin, meaning they bring in more income than they spend. They leave the clinic sooner. And they're doing very well on quality measures. So not knowing what goes on in that lean process, I can tell you I'm very impressed with the output, at least from my friends, you know, Jim Bender, who many of you know. So I'm curious. I have a book on it that I haven't read yet, to admit.
The reason why I bring it up, not so in terms of what can be done, but in terms of the mindset and also the process behind that, it basically, we can separate into the process. Number one is the measurement. And I think I saw that you encourage PhD students to kind of like take a good look where we're at. So the first step, they also encourage the same thing. second thing is after we gather all the data, we form projects. And then the next one is the quality, because it's a moving target. There are so many variables. And the tendency is always trying to change everything. But when we try to change everything, it's very difficult to find out which
right.
one actually makes the most impact.
Yes.
So the quality is by going all the way. We try to prioritize and narrow down to three or five, the top items, and really go after them, and then make changes. And most of the time, we will see the effects right away, but sometimes they cannot stay. So the last one is the control. And the control, I think you hit it on also, is the continuous improvement.
Yes, right.
And basically, it just continues to refine until we're fully satisfied that we can move on to the next stage.
Yeah, so just a couple of comments mm-hmm. on that. One is that children's has also done a lot of
yes.
lean, so,
right,
so those
yeah.
would be two places to look at if you're interested in this. One of the fundamental questions I have about lean as applied to the healthcare system, though, is you look everywhere else that lean has been successfully applied, mm-hmm. the vast majority of the places, you are dealing with a relatively small number of stereotyped things that are being done. And the problem with healthcare, we were just talking about this morning, is there are the 99% of patients have one of 3,000 diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, so lean to build a car better, where every car is the same, is a completely different concept than trying to do lean, where essentially you are building four or five of each of 3,000 different
mm-hmm.
things. And so that's one of the challenges of applying lean to healthcare. There's some places that's fantastic, like
mm-hmm.
clinic workflow, where every patient is registered, every patient is put in a room, every patient is seen, every patient that has things that have to be in every patient discharge. That's very stereotypic.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the things we're talking about here, like decision support rules around
mm-hmm.
around particular diagnoses and particular drugs, the problem is that the landscape is so vast, it makes it really difficult. So I think there are very good places for lean, to apply lean and to apply the aircraft control, airplane error reduction protocols. Yeah, things that you do the same that you do should do and do the same way frequently, those are the places that it works.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that's not mostly where errors are occurring. So most of the errors that are occurring, misdiagnoses and incorrect medication administration
mm-hmm.
are at the fringes. Okay? Not that you don't give someone penicillin, you're allergic to penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, the situations that I've seen in my clinical practice where that has occurred, it's where a drug from this class has a 2% incidence of cross-reacting with a drug from this class. That fact that it's 2% is not well known. It's not in the drug-drug interaction database. And you miss it, and you happen to be one of the 2% where there is that interaction and one of the 2% that has that. So you're talking 2% of 2%. So it's. I think, Tom, your point is really, really valid. And there's like two slides back where you were talking about the need to really study where, you know, this is another... It's not Clemens, it's a generation later, but from UCSF, one of the people in informatics there said, you know, there's a much great desire to apply computers to medicine without first studying where and how they can best be used. And I think we're still in the process of trying to figure this out. But I think things like lean fit very smack dab in that, kind of where and how it can be used. Anyway, thanks very much, Tom.